Hello, friends, and welcome to the most glorious of events, the Movie Mavericks Podcast. This outstanding program is hosted by two fine gentlemen, Jason and Trevor. Now make it so.
MovieMavericks.com.
Hey, you know, everybody, welcome to a bogusly freaked out episode of the Movie Mavericks Podcast. I'm Trevor Anderson, sitting over Jason Rugard, who will tell you what is going on this episode.
Well, speaking for Bill S. Preston Esquire, I am Ted Theodore Logan, and we, of course, are talking about Bill and Ted's and Freaked, a film that you may not have heard of, but it kind of fits in nicely with the Bill and Ted world. So we are going to do a retro on two films this session as opposed to normally the one. But let's start off talking about Freaked. This was your suggestion. So what is Freaked?
That's a good question.
It is a great question. That's why I want you to explain it.
We've both seen it. Yeah, I want you to explain it. It's this black B movie comedy, very dark, like grotesque. You know, I don't know really how to explain it. It's basically Alex Winter plays this actor who is being courted by this company to, I guess, represent or be the spokesperson for some chemical thing that they have going on.
Right.
And so he goes to some third world country. I don't know, which country do they go to?
It's never
some
specified.
South American country.
Yeah, it's not anything specified.
So he goes there and he's getting ready to go to this place to do this commercial, I guess, or whatever, reveal this new chemical. And he gets sidetracked by a little freak show there, run by Randy Quaid, which makes sense.
Yeah, exactly.
I believe that's true in real life. Yeah.
I think he's got freak shows all over the world.
And basically, they wind up using this chemical to transform people into freaks for this freak show. And if it sounds stupid and insane, that's because it is. And this movie knows that it is. You know, it's all tongue in cheek. It's absolutely ridiculous. Balls to the wall ridiculous in many aspects of it. And what I just explained to you takes, you know, what, like 30 minutes to get to. It takes them a long time to even get to the freak show because this movie loves to take little side trips. You know, this is a very zigzaggy type film. I don't know really what kind of comedies you would compare it to, right?
Perhaps I got a couple.
Some things kind of in the vein of Airplane in a way, just with how kind of odd and weird the jokes are. They kind of shoehorned in there a little oddly.
Yeah, it's got visual jokes and written jokes in this movie. Like, so it is very Airplane-esque. I would even put it in with other oddball early 1990s comedies like Cool World, Brain Donors, Brain Candy, Shakes the Clown, Head of the Family, odd movies that were out there. And this is a very 90s film. This came out in 1993. Had a budget of $11 million, up to $13 million, depending on the source. Pretty big money for its day, which is about $25 million today. And it grossed a dismal $29,000, given a very limited release. It was cut down from its 90-minute running time to its current 81-minute running time. Five of that is of credit. So it's really 76 minutes. But it's exactly what you said. It's a fun 76 minutes. It's a lively little comedy. And it's got this irreverent attitude that is kind of infectious by the time that the movie starts really getting in a groove halfway through, I thought. It's so 90s. It's got that opening sequence is about as 90s as you get. It reminds me of something you would have seen on TV with the kids in the hall. And music by the Butthole Surfers. I mean, it's just, first of all, it's makeup by Screaming Mad George, who did The Guyver. And The makeup here looks a little bit like The Guyver. I mean, if you haven't seen The Guyver, stop what you're doing. Get on YouTube and watch the 1990s movies with it starring Mark Hamill. But I like this movie. I thought it's a cheap film, but it's not cheap looking, right? It doesn't betray itself in that way.
Well, it's double-digit millions of dollars were spent here, and you can tell where they went. They definitely went to set design and special effects, and so it has good special effects, but this was the 90s when people these special effects guys back then wanted to work. They would take side jobs, even though these aren't huge, enormous names, but you'll find big name special effects guys back around this time doing very small movies on the side, you know, for fun, because that's the art and that's what they like to do. So yeah, the special effects are fantastic in this. I love the freaks stuff. Yeah. And even the comedy bits, you know, with Mr. T being the bearded lady, right? And I mean, the ridiculous setups for all the freaks, right, as they went through, where he just tells Mr. T's a trucker and pulls into the freak show, whatever, and gets out, and Randy Quaid's just like, you know, you look better without a dick. It's like, what?
And then he gives him a hug, like, thank you.
And then and then Mr. T gets upset. It's like, what? And then they just hug each other. They hug it out.
They have a come to Jesus moment together, and it's unbelievable. The setup for this, the writing is actually pretty decent. There's a lot of jokes being thrown out. And this was courtesy of Winters and his co-director, co-writer, Tom Stern. They did a very little scene MTV show called The Idiot Box that I wasn't a fan of. I vaguely recall it. But it's irreverent tone set the stage for this, really. And they compete. I mean, even when they're driving and they're in the woods, and instead of hearing an actual woodpecker, you hear Woody the Woodpecker. You know, like, I love that little, like, throwaway 1 second gag. And Randy Quaid, who you mentioned as the P.T. Barnum kind of guy of this freak show, is actually quite good in this. He really embraces this.
He used to be good, yeah.
I was surprised. I mean, because I thought, you know, he might have, when I first remembered, oh, Randy Quaid's in this, I thought, oh, is he mailing this in? And he embraced this character, and it seems like he's having a lot of fun. Everybody seems like they're having a blast doing this movie. That's what kind of the infectious attitude I was talking about at the top of the...
Yeah, I mean, it has a fairly big cast, you know, for such a small movie. You know, Alex Winter, obviously Randy Quaid, William Sadler's in this, Bobcat Goldthwait, Mr. T, said Brooke Shields, Megan Ward, who, if you don't know who that is, you obviously have never seen Encino Man.
Hey, how dare you have never seen Encino Man? That's where I knew I was in love with her from back in the day. You know what I mean?
From Encino Man, yeah.
A lot of people were in love with the girl from Can't Buy Me Love. Amanda Peterson was her name? No, I think I'd be right.
I don't know. I wasn't.
You know what I'm talking about, though.
The girl but I was not a big. I wasn't big into that movie. So,
but I was big into Encino Man. But the name you did not mention amongst the cast list was Keanu Reeves as Dog Boy,
right?
First of all, out of the freaks, who's your favorite?
The Hammer.
Really? You like that? I love that backstory when Randy Quaid goes and buys this wrench and then turns it into a hammer, and they give it a flashback montage. Once again, speaking to that irreverent tone.
There's the whole thing where Randy Quaid has this computer, and he's got that he can program in, like,
what I love that.
Like, how he changes the freaks, which makes no sense.
What software is that?
I'd like to see the thing that he wrote for Mr. T, you know, just remove the wiener. That's it, you know? But at one point they're going through. Alex Winter's character's met all the freaks, right? And so they're going down one by one and telling them the story about how they wound up at this freak show place, and Randy Quaid turned them into freaks. And when they get down to the end of the line, the camera pans down and there's just this hammer laying on the floor. And it goes back to, as you said, to the recap of it was a wrench, you know, that Randy Quaid bought, and he apparently turned it into a hammer.
That son of a bitch. This is a very... First of all, this is the kind of movie, the gem you discover on HBO on a lazy, rainy afternoon or a late night.
That's what this felt like, right? Like a VHS rental that you're just like, what is this? And you watch it and you just think, God, how does this exist, and how many people know about this?
Yeah, and in pre-internet days, it was hard. You'd catch this, and you would not know what it was. There was no guide on the television. You would tell your friends, and you're trying to piece together what this was. I came to this while I was home battling poison oak in the seventh grade. Did I ever tell you that story? I'm deathly allergic to poison oak, by the way, so that's my kryptonite. And last time I got it, in fact, was with making a film with you for our Western that we did, and I jumped down to get that shot of you walking across the bridge, and I got some poison oak. It's been years now, but wasn't nearly as bad. But in seventh grade, I went tromping through the woods with my buddy and woke up and had it everywhere. Missed 3 weeks of school. Damn near didn't graduate the seventh grade because I got it internally. It was so bad. However, I was home for a long time watching a lot of fucking movies on HBO during this period, as you can imagine. I had this movie on a tape. I had taped this, Blood Fist 3, and Stone Cold. I mean, that's a tape of pure shit right there, right?
That's a beautiful tape.
That was one of my most coveted VHS tapes for many years after. So I was quite familiar with this, but I was happy to know, I'm sure Alice Winter isn't happy to know this, but I was happy to find that this is available for free on YouTube. So if you're interested in this movie at all, you can go right
illegally,
now and watch it.
I believe, but yes.
It is available, though, and it's been in there for a couple of years now. It was in a queue of mine.
Oh, for sure.
So no one has taken it down. I wonder what the rights situation on this is. I want to say Paramount had a hand in releasing this at one point, or it was on... Does that sound right?
Well, this is 20th. This is Fox.
Oh, is it Fox? Okay. Well, I knew there was a studio involved to some extent.
I don't think... Yeah, I mean, I don't think this was a Viacom, you know, MTV Paramount thing. I think it was all Fox. Oh, no, it was Fox because they bought the movie, they paid for it. And then the reason that this didn't come out wide was because a studio had changed, right? And then the new guys came in and they thought, this is ridiculous, you know? Who's going to want to see this thing? So it was never widely distributed here.
Well, getting back to my favorite... And your favorite freaks. Is the Hammer really your favorite freak?
No.
Well, who's your favorite freak?
No. It's a hard question, I guess, because it doesn't really matter. They don't really do anything special. So I guess really, if I had to say makeup and effects and stuff, I would say Alex Winter's character. I really liked that half gremlin thing he had going on. It was pretty cool.
It was very much like a creature villain in the Guyver.
And to be fair, they do have the when they, you know, take the, you know, the, when they turn into Super Shredder, right? They take Super Ooze or whatever.
Yeah, it's
the super
like
chemical
that.
At the end. Yeah, and there and there's two enormous freaks at the end, right? Alex Winter and then the one little kid character who's in the movie, who's his biggest fan that follows him around and annoys the shit out of him.
I love that character.
He turns into an enormous thing, too, and so that's fun, but I don't know. Who's your favorite?
I actually like the worm.
The worm?
The worm, the makeup on the worm is very clever, and the fact that he doesn't turn back later, and they don't give any explanation to that, right? He just decides not...
Oh, no, there is. They remember, at the end of the movie, they basically say that Randy Quaid says they have a cure for this, right? But it was in a time release baked into the cookies. They find.
Oh,
they
it's find, right. They find cookies, he didn't have
and
the cookies.
Worm doesn't. He doesn't like the cookies. I can't remember what kind of cookies they were.
I can't either. It was something with an
M. I don't remember. But he doesn't like them, so he doesn't eat them. So he doesn't get the cure. You know.
That's right. I like him, and I like the cowboy, the literal cow.
Yeah, the cowboy.
It's a
good
boy.
Too.
It's such a good looking costume there.
There's so much hysterical things in here. I mean, the milkman gag where they. They're trying to figure a way to escape, right? And the dog boy or whatever has this idea, and they don't let Alex Winter in on it because they think he's an asshole. And then their idea only is able to encapsulate like whatever how many of them are like eight. How many freaks are there?
There's six or eight of them
or something. I don't know. There's a lot.
Yeah.
But they can't do one more, right? It won't work without that. And so Alex Winter goes on his own escape plan, and he decides to beat up the milkman who's making his delivery and pretend like he's the milkman, right? And then get out that way. And, of course, he gets caught. But on his way back, he runs into all these guys who've all dressed up as milkmen. They had this, that was exactly their idea, right? It's funny. It's ridiculous.
It's a very easy watch. It moves very fast. I think that the first 40 minutes are a little bit easier to watch than the last 40. It gets kind of off on its own. But it, you know, it's like I said, it moves like lightning across 82 minutes. And if you think that's an easy accomplishment, go back and watch something like Inspector Gadget from 1999, which is 82 minutes as well, and it's impossible to get through. This actually moves and has a sense of humor about itself and knows what it's doing. It's anti-corporation. It's anti-messing up the environment. You know, I love when Randy Quaid finds he's involved in all this hiding of chemicals and hurting things and people, but yet finds the styrofoam cup and says, this thing's bad for the environment. You know, it's got a whole idea of what it wants to do, and it sets out and does it pretty well. The Twilight director, Catherine Hardwicke, was the production designer on this film. And you look at these credits, and it's just littered with people. I mean, three different visual effects company were involved in getting this done. And you brought up that these guys used to like to work just to stay working. And I would say that I think this is the same year that Theodore Rex, Stan Winston's movie, A Gnome Named Gnome, remember that one with Michael Anthony Hall?
Sure.
Those all kind of came out in the same time. A lot of these special effects guys were getting their chance at directing as well. I think And You Thought Your Parents Were Weird, that one was out. A couple other random ones over the years, including the Guyver. I keep going back to that, but I watched this and I was like, oh, I got to watch the Guyver because it's so...
I know, it does make you want to watch more... anything with a monster type effect in it. There was this old school, you know?
Yeah, it just looked like a lot of love and care had gone into that, as opposed to somebody created it in a computer and just had it smashing around. It was more engaging, at least. I'm glad we went back and watched this. How long had it been since you've seen this? Years? I mean, why did you suggest this? How did this
work out? Forever.
Where did you stumble upon this at?
On YouTube, and I thought, well, shit, you know? I should watch that again. it's been literally for. I mean, you can't find. I don't even know if you could find this anywhere, right?
Especially not now. Yeah, I still have the mail.
No, order. I don't think it's on DVD. So.
Yeah, I don't think they ever pressed it on DVD. It was on VHS. There was definitely a copy on VHS.
That's what I'm saying. But where would you? Yeah, I mean, you'd never come across that, you know, unless you specifically went and looked for it somewhere. I don't even know how you'd find it, really. You'd have to go on eBay, right, and hope someone would put it up there. But yeah, I mean, not a very widespread movie. I mean, a true cult classic, as you had said to me after we watched this, that yeah, I mean, this is a movie even today where you mention it and people won't know what the hell you're talking about. You know, they'll have to go seek it out and find it.
Well, people like to use the term cult classic very loosely. They'll apply it to anything that didn't hit at the box office. I mean, when you and I were in film school, people talked about Memento and Donnie Darko being cult classics. And I argue if it's something's widely available and you don't have to get like an imported copy from Japan or hunt that fucker down on Amazon or eBay, then it's not really a cult classic because everyone's got it. I can't go to a secondhand store that sells DVDs, VHSs, and find this even. So
yeah,
it amazes me that this is on YouTube, and maybe that's why it is, because, you know, things even like Beastmaster 2 are on YouTube for free, and that's, believe it or not, very hard to hunt down. Whether you want to or not is a different story, but it's just...
That would be that hard to find. That should be on DVD.
It's not widely
available.
All three
of them should be. Really?
Yeah, the first one for sure is the third one.
I mean, they're probably out of print.
That's what I mean. Nobody's not much care. And this is definitely out of print. This was a financial loser, but a film that I really respected growing up because of the touch that was given to it. And it has so many deviations in it. It's almost like watching a Kentucky Fried movie or something like that, Airplane, like you said, because
yeah,
it's a full experience in 82 minutes, and not necessarily because of what the story does, but because of what's going on visually and through the audio and sight gags and all that kind of stuff. Let's now morph this into another Alex Winters film, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. Not the excellent adventure of the first one, but the sequel.
No.
The 1991 film. And this movie, this is a kind of a strange thing. This was released July 19th, 1991, just 1 week after Point Break. So Keanu Reeves had two films in the marketplace, one that asked you to take him as a serious action star.
Yeah, two completely different, right?
And one where he's basically a glorified kids movie, right? So they both made about the same. Point Break edged a little bit, even though Bill and Ted's opened up bigger. It didn't make as much in the long run. Both did healthy, about 80 to 90 million adjusted. But such a strange, it's just a strange thing to me. And I was wondering why they would have done this. That must have just been really irritating to him, to undermine his career, because you can see where he wanted to go, and after all this time they're talking about doubling back and doing another Bill and Ted's. Would you welcome another one after watching this?
Which would almost never happen, it seems like, since it's been almost a decade now since they've had the script written, they claim.
Yeah, they've claimed.
I'd welcome another one because I think you know, we talked last episode about Eddie Murphy and like where characters would be, you know, would be kind of the most interesting thing if you're going to take such a long time in between sequels. And I could imagine these characters still being the same way they are now, but they, you know, the married with kids, but still being complete freaking morons.
As an adult, too. That would be fun. Apparently, there was a Bill and Ted's 3 script written in the early 90s. It was modified, retooled, recast, and plot elements were recycled for the film Biodome, which kind of makes sense looking back on that.
Yeah, which is a movie that I love for absolutely no reason whatsoever.
Yeah, I wouldn't say love, but I definitely have watched it way too many times for how bad it is.
You got to say love because you can put it on and you can just watch it.
And I think this Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, though, is a step above Biodome. And this is a good-looking sequel that at times has better production design and legit sci-fi films of the era. Like Mario Brothers, Double Dragon, Mom and Dad Save the World. That's what this world reminded me of.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those weird 90s family-esque comedies like the ones you mentioned. Obviously, Mario Brothers is the one need not be mentioned ever.
Yeah,
the Voldemort terrible, movies. Terrible movie. Mom and Dad Save the World I do like, but it has a lot of the similar, weird kind of, props and things, you know, like
sets even
like the machinery that people build things out of. It's almost like a Dr. Seuss type, you know, look and feel to the things. Clearly they're not real, you know, but they're from another world, or they're, you know, science fiction or whatever they are. And this movie's full of that.
Well, coincidentally, the writers of this film, Chris Matheson and Ed Solomon, wrote Bill, Mom and Dad Save the World. So they actually wrote that film too, and that was the year after Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, and there was some cross use of production design space, including the set where the students are in the beginning, it says here. Ed Solomon would go on to write Men in Black, and there is even some of that, I feel, in this early goings here. How fucking retro is it, though, that they travel in a phone booth? I mean, how great is that?
Yeah, I know, right? Well, and that would be something that would be interesting. How are they going to do that now, right?
Yeah, what would be your... That's maybe a reason to keep this for what it is. Because the thing with Bill and Ted that I never really got is a couple of things. Let's clear this up at the top here. It's implied that they're stoners, right? Because they're never shown smoking. Is it implied, right? Or are they just idiots? Are they stoned or are they idiots?
Well, I feel like it's the... They're just idiots because they couldn't, you know, show them. But it's the idea, you know, that they're stoners.
Is it the same idea? Like, do you get the same vibe from Wayne's World?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so that's me as well. So, like, they can't show it, but it's obviously implied. But the thing here is, are Bill and Ted virgins? Because they keep talking about their girlfriends going home and they're being chased and prudish and whatnot. Are you getting that they're virginal too?
No, I never got that, huh?
I thought that they were virginal. That's why at the end when they had the babies, I thought, oh, this is kind of a strange thing when they see their future versions with children.
I never got that out of this. I do think it's the language that they use was interesting in this movie, especially the use of the word fag.
Yes.
Which is several times throughout the movie and feels very out of place at times.
You know, we talked about on our last review show, I talked about mid-90s, the Jonah Hill movie, and that was a film that used that term more than a few times, but it was correct for the time that we were in. You know, it's like when you watch a 50s film on racial matters and they use very coarse language, and that was accurate for the time that they're depicting. So the time that this was released, this is a kid's movie, a PG movie, I believe, PG-13. And it was literally PG, and it was released with that. So that shows how insensitive we were to that kind of thing going on. This was released in 91, like I said, and there was a lot of robot movies in 91. We had T2, which this was up at the box office against, Bill and Ted's 2. Remember Eve of Destruction, Gregory Hines?
Uh-huh.
I mean, these are all 1991. We were really going for robot movies in 91. I mean, there was also, I'm sure, Albert Payoun movies that we didn't even mention.
That was coming out of the 80s, right, which had a lot of robot movies as well, especially towards the end of the 80s.
Did you notice before, because I just picked this up rewatching it, the Scooby-Doo influence on this from the van that they drive that looks like the Mystery Mobile to the reveal at the end when Rufus is there and he's not only was I this character, I was this person following. Did you pick that up when you were younger and did you see it this time?
No. I just saw more similarities between this and Wayne's World. You know, I mean, just saying what you just said right there. Well, yeah, they have the Scooby-Doo Indiana Wayne's World.
That's true.
And these characters are so similar to Wayne and Garth. They act very similar. I don't. It's just as weird of a universe that they live in. You know, this is literally something that could happen to Wayne and Garth.
You're right. I didn't think about it like that. And Bill and Ted's predates that. I'm not sure if it predates the skit. The first film was 89, so you got to imagine that script was at least going in 87 or 88. So I'm not sure when they debuted Wayne's World on television. But they couldn't have cast it any better. I mean, Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves have a great on-screen relationship. It sounds like they had a great off-screen relationship too. And these guys are morons, but they're not obnoxious. And that's a hard line to walk, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, these characters are meant to be just really stupid. You know, comparing them to Wayne and Garth, I guess, isn't fair because Wayne and Garth are really intelligent. Whereas these guys are not at all by any means, right? Like it takes them a while to get to realize things.
Even in this movie,
it takes them a while to pick up on stuff. Like that's how dumb they are. But I don't know. Do you like this movie better than the original or
I do.
The first one? Me too. I always liked this more as a kid. I really loved this movie. And especially the whole thing with Death. I just thought, William Sadler is fantastic as Death. And then they start just kind of like palling around with him. I don't know the way they move around this movie and kind of pick up characters, and wind up with the team at the end of it. It's just a weird, you know, team, right? Obviously, you know, you have the Grim Reaper and then you have
Stations. Which is like early Groot. It's all he says is Station. I don't know
how to explain. Yeah, how do you explain that thing?
He's like Groot in 91. Little fucking.
He is like Groot. They're like two little weird, fat, troll-like aliens that can come together to make one big troll alien. It's weird.
And
then the robots, right?
You could almost see where Alex Winter would get the inspiration to do something like Freak, too, because of the odd kind of characters here and some of the really effective use of low-budget special effects with heads on the ground that are coming through the walls and things, you know, like low-budget special effects stuff that works here. This is in the somewhat infancy of computer-generated imagery, and there's obviously times when it's a double. I mean, there's one clear time where Keanu Reeves has the robot behind him and it's a stand-in, yeah. And then they cut back and it's him. But the special effects are fairly well done for what they are in the time period as well. But the makeup effects are really good here. And it's got the damn near the same cast as Freaked here with Reeves, Winter, and Sandler, William Sandler, who's great as Death here. What other kids movie has a Bergman reference from The Seventh Seal as Death, you know, and playing the games. They play Battleship, Clue, and Twister. And he almost steals the movie. He's hilarious throughout the movie. Even when they go to the Home Depot at the end.
When they go to heaven. Yeah, when they go to Home Depot. I mean, I even like when they take the sidetrack to hell, you know, and go through hell and they have to go through the different doors and talk to the devil, the big devil guy, you know, they're trying to. All that stuff's just fantastic. You know, it's just I don't know. I just love the look of these. I guess maybe because I was a kid when these were around, but the look of these 90s movies, you know, the sets, the props, the special effects, it just feels bigger than life to me when I watch these. Even now, watching this feels more real. Like I could reach out and touch this more so than a completely like CGI movie, you know.
Yeah, it hits home a little bit more. I know it looks.
Yeah.
It's obviously a corny movie in a lot of respects, but I know what you say there's something tangible about it. There's a lived-in quality to it that you don't normally get, and I appreciated that too. And I'm glad you brought up the fact that you prefer this over the original. They both have such a cool concept. You know, the idea that you can get historical characters and bring them into the time when you're studying them is a great idea, but this takes it into such a madcap, odd direction.
Yeah, I just thought this was a funner movie in general.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. And I like that they continued some of the running jokes, you know, the Missy character, who is now the girl they went to high school with, who's now their is Bill's or Ted's stepmom, and not Bill's any longer.
I know, I love that. I love that scene where
She kisses the dad.
Yeah. Well, and even he says, he says, if your mom like marries my, what was it, like if you marry my mom or something, you could be your own stepdad. Like, yes. He gets totally wrong. Like whatever Bill says to Ted of that scene, I can't remember exactly what it is, but it's clearly incorrect. Like, they don't understand how it works, you know?
Which makes them to me like virginal in a sense. And the fact that like the character's not attracted to them is funny too, because they're the same age. But I like too when she has the seance later and they crash that. I mean, yes. It's exactly something that she would be doing.
Even now, I just forgot about that. There's so much going on in this movie. It's so, I just think it's so fun, you know?
It's busy.
Yeah, I mean, I love the Star Trek episode. Then they go to
the actual location.
You know, whatever that is, the rocks.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it's called now, but yeah. And they just, like, all the way this movie just kind of keeps moving. It doesn't really take its foot off the gas, but it's always mindful of where it's going somehow, even though you have no idea. Like, it's been set up in some way, you know? Like, you're going to see things over and over again.
And it's nice to see George Carlin on screen. I always forget he's in these movies, and he's perfectly cast as Rufus, as their handler or mentor or whatever you want to call it, right? And it ties in so nicely that they are, you know, the world is based on their music and their teachings and whatever. And you think, well, how could that be? And then at the end there, when the whole world is watching and then they start playing, it just ties everything into that kind of Back to the Future mentality or the paradox, the time travel paradox there. It works out well.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it all kind of works itself out really well. I have the VHS copy of this, although I watched this on pristine Amazon, and the colors really popped on Amazon. I thought they did a good job on the HD transfer there. This on VHS, however, looks like utter shit. But let me tell you what my VHS box says here. It features Slaughter's music video, Shout It Out. So I got I got the joy of looking at music video from 1991 intermixed with images from the movie. Remember when they used to do that? They would just cut in images, like scenes from the movie over the soundtrack for whatever reason. This is probably back when they sold a shitload of soundtracks.
Yeah, well, and then it used to be, you'd have the music video, and then you'd have the movie music video, which would be the music video, but yeah, with just scenes of the movie cut in.
Right, yeah, and you never knew which one they was going to show. Sometimes they would show the movie one for a while, and then they would go to a different one. When it was by no means is Slaughter's Shout It Out a good song or music video. It just happened to be a little 90s nostalgia here.
It was the one they could afford.
And the movie, for what all it is, it was never fondly remembered. I feel like everybody remembers the first one. This was turned into a cartoon series. Remember that? Bill and Ted's?
No.
Oh, yeah. It was a cartoon.
Might have been.
Yeah, I want to say it was on television as a cartoon series. I should probably
double-check that.
Yeah, here it is. An animated series
that
ran on CBS in 1990 and featured the Winters, Reeves, and Carlin.
Oh, wow.
A second season ran for 8 episodes on Fox Kids with the voice cast recast. And then during 1992, there was a live-action series that only ran for 7 episodes on Fox. And it did not feature any of the cast and was portrayed by Evan Richards and Christopher Kennedy in the title roles. DC Comics also published a 12-issue series of them back in 1991-92 to coincide with this. And there were video games for Game Boy, NES, Atari Lynx.
Of course. I remember the video games.
Commodore 64. I don't recall the video games at all. Were those any good? Or were they just terrible?
No, as with all movie video games back in the day, they're not good.
Well, do you know that they had their own theme park attraction?
No.
Yes.
It's a phone booth? Those are everywhere, man. That's not a real attraction.
It's only for pervs in New York. It was part of the Halloween Horror Nights at Universal Studios Orlando. It had been featured from 92 to 99. It was Bill and Ted's Excellent Halloween Adventure. A show satirizing pop culture.
Orlando, no wonder.
Yep. and they fought villains who steal their phone booth for their own schemes. So the film had a life in pop culture after the fact, on television, all that kind of stuff. So I guess it does have some sort of following, but I don't think kids today have any clue who Bill and Ted are, right? Like, or any need for them?
Kids? No, I don't think so.
Yeah,
need for them? I mean, there's so many movies and shows for kids these days. Yeah, this would be a hard sell, you know? I mean, when you think about it, we live in a world with content, right? Content, like new content, right? And you look at, like, the kids shows that we used to have would just replay the same, you know, 8 episodes for over the year, and that would be, right, enough.
Yes.
Right? You'd see a lot of repeats when we were kids.
Lots.
And that includes rewatching movies a lot and seeing a lot of repeats for television, and syndication was a big thing because of that. But nowadays, I don't know, even when I consume content now, it's rare to go back and rewatch things.
It's too much. I was talking about this.
And there's so much of it. Even with TV shows now, you know, you'll watch, there's only 13 episodes now. Now they've scaled back for a lot of TV shows, but there's 8 million TV shows.
I was talking about this with somebody recently. I would go to somebody's house. They would have X amount of things on tape or DVD, and that's what you watched. And because what they had, you watched it. And when they came to your place, it was the same thing. When you got to the point now, the same thing with music, where you can listen to anything or watch everything, it's overwhelming. It's, nothing has any sort of replayability. Yeah. And some movies or CDs, music or songs, need to be re-listened to be absorbed, or rewatched to be absorbed. And I'm telling you, reasons I liked Freaked when I was a kid, because I saw it so many fucking times, you know, like... It wasn't just because it was entertaining. It was because I knew what scene was coming next, or X, Y, and right. Z. There's some kind of a comfort in knowing your stories very well. Where I can't even tell you the plot of most movies I watch now, 20 minutes after I've seen them, because it's just another one in the drop in the bucket. We digress.
I agree. I agree. I do think that's interesting nowadays, and something that will probably never come back. You know, I just don't think people are going to watch stuff. That's why home video sales have gone down, you know, so much. Because there's no point in owning it, right? Because you're not going to there's too much new to watch. How are you going to watch the old stuff, you know? It's unfortunate, but... And there's so much good old stuff, too.
Yeah, there is. That's why when... looking back at stuff, I get caught up watching this old stuff, because it's a different type of movie making, it's a different type of writing, and just all together, like you said, just from the production design to the delivery of things, and I enjoy it sometimes. Other times it can be tin on the ear when you hear something like, you know, the word fag used, and it's like, oh, geez. But it's also very comforting to see people not using their cell phones as a plot device or plot element, you know, and they just made better movies in a lot of ways, and also worse movies. So strange, but 90s weren't that long ago, and movies from them look a lot like movies still from today in a lot of ways, and I thought they had a lot more heart back then, which may sound contradictory depending on what you just said about using certain epithets, but still, they were a lot warmer.
Yeah, they said things, but they were... Movies back then were a lot more, they rode both sides of the line, I guess. How would you explain it? They dealt in differences, right? A lot more than we do now. Nowadays, you get the one message and that's what you get. But back then, they would contrast stuff a lot more. You know, you get the salty yet sweet, right? You'd get that a way, way more, which is, I think, something, a reason why I like Kevin Smith movies so much, because he does that. And clearly, you know, a child of the 80s and 90s, and so his movies still to this day, I feel like they carry that kind of idea on of being really gross and kind of nasty, but then suddenly, oh, very sweet, you know.
I would say that movies in the 70s and for the most part of the 80s, not including Spielberg stuff or Lucas stuff, was very cynical. And then things became very ironic. And I think that the 90s movies, even like the Kevin Smith stuff, has a lot of irony in it.
Irony was a big thing in the 90s, yeah, especially. I mean, just look at Seinfeld and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Know? Yeah.
And how great is it to see Orion Pictures' logo at the beginning of this
film? Oh, I love it. I'm so glad that that's come back. I just wish they would put it on a good movie.
I know, right? It's like seeing the lion roar before a film. You're like, oh, wow. I remember when this meant that it was going to be a second tier film. It's like watching the Canon film or something. Well, that's going to wrap it up for our podcast here on our retro look back for Freaked and Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. We want to thank you guys for hanging with us on this retro. We'll be back next week with an Entourage look back for episode 4, I believe we're on there. Join us for that. Speaking for Bill S. Preston Esquire, I'm Ted Theodore Logan, and we are the Movie Mavericks.
Oh my, another magnificent episode has come to an end. If you're craving more, set your destination to moviemavericks.com/warp9. Engage!